From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Geared, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games. In this episode, we talk with Chris Roberts, game designer and vehicle specialist, to discuss vehicle design. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Okay, who's excited about this? Because it's a very specific topic.
I mean, I am.
Which I feel we haven't done in a while with a guest.
Yeah.
And so before introducing, I just want to take the temperature at the table. Like, who's revved about, like, getting into it?
Revved.
Okay.
Yeah. Vroom.
Okay, good, good. All right, all three ready to go. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. I think we can start with a bit of a introduction. Maybe why don't you tell folks exactly? I mean, you're here as an expert on this particular topic.
Yeah.
Let's hear those bona fides.
Okay. I've been in the video game industry since the turn of the century. I started off at Rockstar Games. Actually, we were Angel Studios when I joined. I was an independent third-party developer that got acquired by Rockstar when Grand Theft Auto 3 happened and all the money was falling out of the sky.
Ah, yeah.
So the first phase of my career was on the Midnight Club, open city racing games that Rockstar published and stuff. And my introduction to the industry was as a production assistant on Midnight Club 2. Okay. So that's how I sort of got my foot in the door. But on the subsequent games, I moved into the design group and sort of grew into a role where I was the designer who just played with the cars all the time.
Okay.
That became my full-time job and role. And by the time we got to the last one was Midnight Club Los Angeles for Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3. And in that game, everything the player does, driving the car, all the vehicle dynamics, all the camera controls, all the controller inputs, the traffic dynamics, the AI balancing, all that, you know, the visceral driving experience were all systems I was principally responsible for. I didn't do the heavy lifting and the vehicle programming or the physics and that, and I didn't have anything to do with race design or characters or economy or all the other game design components, but the actual driving experience was pretty much all all me.
Wow.
And that was like a dream come true. I loved it. And then I switched gears a little bit. The last Rockstar game I worked on was a little cowboy Western thing, Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah.
You might have heard of it. And from that, I was the lead multiplayer designer, which was a huge departure for me in terms of historically, I'd always been an individual contributor, just working on my own and working with other people. But on the multiplayer team, I was in charge of quite a group, and it was really challenging and it nearly killed me. So after RDR, I did resign from Rockstar and I took a sabbatical year. And when I came back to work, I effectively got an opportunity at Sony Online Entertainment here in San Diego to work on PlanetSide 2 with all the vehicles and stuff they had. And I was able to finagle being a contract, long-term consultant sort of engagement rather than as an employee. So since I left Rockstar, I've been successful at having a freelance contract, whatever the client wants to call it, career, where I haven't been anybody's employee again, which has been tremendous. And it's made it so that I could set boundaries. Most of the time when I negotiate a new gig, my stance is don't schedule me for more than 20 hours a week. I'll be a 20-hour a week resource on your team. And especially when I've been on site at Sony or Daybreak or other studio, Amazon here in San Diego, I suggest the schedule is that I'll be there Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. But I'm out Mondays and Fridays, and I don't work the weekend. and if that works for you and we can integrate with your team, that's fantastic. The last project I was working on for a big studio was at Valve up in Seattle. And that was the first opportunity I had to work remotely, which was tremendous. Yeah. And I'm hoping that future engagements will be similar to that, where I was on a Valve breaks up into what they call cabals. So I was on a 5-person cabal team working on vehicle prototyping for Source 2, which I would describe more as fundamental research rather than actual game design.
Sure.
Since Source 2 is the current Valve engine and they've never had vehicle systems. In Rubicon Physics is the physics component in Source 2.
Okay.
And I was recruited effectively by the principal engineer behind Rubicon because he wanted to do vehicle experiments, but knew he didn't know how to approach it. And so I was sort of brought in to help with the team. And basically the cabal was me and a programmer who was like a principal vehicle guy who had been at Forza working on Turn 10 Studios, and two level designers and an artist.
Yeah.
And it was the best experience as far as just prototyping and doing experiments. It's like all the things that historically any project I was involved with was usually already on fire.
Yeah.
I was brought in.
Yeah.
So this was the first time it was like blue sky from the ground up. It's like, we don't have anything, but we've got really solid physics and we've got really solid game engine. You know, what, how do we approach it? What do we want to do? And all the typical things about, I don't know, do we want rigid body, solid collision wheels? Do we want ray casting wheels? How do we want the suspension? And it's like all those sorts of things. We could experiment. The level designers would build, you know, environments for us and, you know, vehicle prototype stuff. And the programmer and I would work on iterating through systems. And it was just a dream come true. So I don't know. Long story short, I've been in the industry for 26 years and have had the opportunity to work on some pretty big projects and a couple of little things. But most of what I've done has been principally vehicle design. And at the end of the day, I would actually say most of what I've had the opportunity to do professionally, I would do for free. You know,
that's the secret we all share, but none of us want to get out, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't, and my wife is very protective, making sure that I negotiate and get paid appropriately.
Right.
I mean, we're here to talk about vehicles, but I am actually quite fascinated by the career story that you've laid out for us. So before we move on to the actual topic of the show, I want to ask a little bit about your time at the end of your time at Rockstar, as you were in a more managerial role. It had nothing to do with vehicles.
Yeah.
And then when you left, you took your sabbatical and you came back as a freelancer and launched your big second act. It seems like it was all about vehicles again.
Absolutely.
That is so fascinating to me. During that time on Red Dead, I'm sure it was really rewarding. You described it as challenging, but were you just aching to do you maybe say, hey, maybe we could secretly put a car in this game?
Horses just don't have the same feel.
We had stagecoaches.
Yeah,
that supported.
There's trains. You
know, I think there were capacity for five passengers, and the articulated, all the joints and physics constraints and stuff in those stagecoaches were so much more complicated than any normal vehicle, like any of the Midnight Club cars or anything like that. They're so simple in comparison.
Yeah.
But I guess to answer the question, no. At the time, I wasn't, desperate to get back to vehicles. Okay. And everybody sort of jokes and asks me if I tuned the horses and stuff like that, which I kind of did in multiplayer.
Yeah.
When you got to the top of the ranking and you prestiged to reset and go back through again, every time you did that, you got a different mount. Uh-huh. So in multiplayer, when you would whistle for your horse, when you were a new newbie player, you got the donkey.
Oh,
and that was your mount. And then the second time you prestiged, you got a normal horse, and then you got the fancy horse, and then you got the black stallion, and then you got the bear.
Oh.
And then there was the buffalo, and we had a whole series of specialty mounts.
Yeah.
So you really start at Sancho Panza and work your way up through the animal ladder.
Exactly. So I did, in the final one, the best mount in the whole game was the zebra donkey.
Oh.
It was sort of in Tijuana, the joke. I mean, there historically there would be photo opportunities where tourists could get themselves with a photo taken with this poor little donkey that they had painted like a zebra.
Oh, dang.
So I did tune all the parameters for those specialty mounts as far as their stamina and hill climbing ability and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
I think I had maybe three design contributions where I actually did something in the game other than just sort of trying to keep the team going in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, it seems like your passion still found its way to expression.
A little bit.
Even when it was designed to give you as little of those opportunities as possible, you still found them.
Mm. Right.
That's great.
But I think what that experience did teach me was I didn't want to be responsible for other people's work product.
Yeah.
You know, it was unexpected. I thought I was leaving Midnight Club because I felt like I was kind of being a little bit pigeonholed into that role.
Sure.
And there were two options. I could either join the Rage technical team because they needed a designer who could do like fairly specific ragdoll tuning and physics interaction and stuff like that. Mm. Or I had the option to join Red Dead as a multiplayer designer. So that's what I thought I was doing. But it turned out the Christian Contamasso is the lead designer on the whole project. And after I had been on the team for a couple months, I remember a conversation with Christian where he sort of pulled me aside and said, I have no bandwidth multiplayer at all. Mm. So I want you to do it and let me know how it goes. So I sort of unexpectedly ended up in a leadership role that I wasn't anticipating and stuff like that. Sure, and it just evolved over time and stuff. So at the end of it, it was super challenging, but I'm proud of what we made.
Yeah.
I think it was, you know, a lifetime experience, but it also taught me I never want to do that again.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have had that experience of promotion by vacuum.
Yep.
And it's what you do with that, what you do next is sort of a test of what your career is and what your interests are. And it's interesting that how you were able to navigate that moment. That's really cool.
Let's get into the meat and potatoes, I say. Talking about cars, vehicles of all shapes and sizes, I think. I don't know a lot about cars.
Yeah, I've already made this mistake in this episode, really just thinking about cars.
Yeah,
it's a bigger topic than that.
Yeah. So you've described currently the way that you are working on things is like, what kind of vehicles specifically have you been designing recently?
Recently, it's been a motorcycle. And that's been fascinating as far as like some, I can't really talk about the details too much, but some novel controller input considerations.
Okay.
Especially one of the most challenging things is PC game input. Mouse and keyboard is the primary, you know, especially if it's a primarily first person shooter-ish game. You jump into a vehicle and you've still got these binary controls where it's like, you know, WASD on the keyboard and look around with the mouse. People end up tapping keys in rapid succession to, you know, try and approximate analog inputs, or, you know, it's really challenging.
Sometimes
it's also a balancing act when you have a game that's multi-platform and you have like the PlayStation version does have analog controls and the PC version does not. Back to your question, the most recent one is motorcycle stuff. And that's been cool because it's all terrain and, you know, relatively unrestricted as far as like how it deals with, you know, getting from point A to point B. Hmm. But I've had the opportunity to work on pretty much I haven't done much with boats.
Okay.
But ground vehicles, aircraft, science fiction, sort of artificial flight simulation, stuff like that.
Okay.
There's basically, I would say, four categories. Some games are like racing games where the performance and the actual like competitive lap time is the game dynamic.
Yeah.
Other games have combat where, you know, the vehicle is a weapon.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You and your crew need to get from point A to B sometimes, or it's just about moving around and, you know, being a mobile artillery or, you know, combat device.
Right. Right.
And then there's games where it's like, you know, the vehicle primarily just serves as transportation. You know, you and maybe your crew need to get from one part of the map to another, and the vehicle is the most effective way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it seems like there's games where it's just a vehicle playground, BMMG or SnowRunner and stuff like that, where it's just, you just play with the vehicle dynamics. And if it's successful, it's like, that's fun all by itself. Mm-hmm. You don't need to scaffold a whole game around it. You can just have, you know, an engaging vehicle dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to know what is universal about the experience of what makes a vehicle different from, say, a standard player controller.
Yeah.
Because really, when you break it down, if you want to like remove all the artifice, a first person or third person game, you're still a vehicle. It's just the character model.
Right.
And I would guess that the difference is that in a character controller, precision and is more important. And then in any kind of vehicle, the simulation is where the fun is. But is that true? Are there degrees of that? And what makes a plane different from a car in that way? Are they themselves very different, or are they equally different from just a player controller?
I think the gist of your question, what really comes down to, is physics. Even in the most arcade, unrealistic, you know, exaggerated Ridge Racer kind of thing, physics is important. And it's basically, you know, how well the game simulates the physical interaction is what sort of drives the rest of the game design interaction with the vehicle. And in a player controller, you might slide, or you might tumble, or you might, you know, be subject to gravity if you jump and stuff like that. But to be successful in a game, the vehicle needs to convince the player that it's actually, you know, driving, and that there's wheels and there's friction and there's traction and there's sliding out and, you know, drifting and all the dynamics you expect. So in my experience, even the most exaggerated, crazy, sort of unrealistic gameplay really still requires the best real-time physics simulation your engineers can muster. Because if that's good, then you can layer all the sort of artificial stuff on top of that and, you know, make it so that it's not realistic, but, you know, still has that core. If you don't, and there's lots of games that kind of don't have a good, you know, real physics simulation at the core of their vehicle, it sort of feels like you're just sort of pushing a block around the map, and it doesn't sort of convince you that it actually has that dynamic.
Right.
It's just sort of, and then, you know, the difference between a real vehicle simulation and a horse with pants or, you know, something like that. But, you know, and sometimes there's, you know, conversations or arguments with production and stuff like that, where specifically on one of the games I was working on, there was an executive who really wanted bicycles in the game. And we didn't have a good two-wheel vehicle simulation. And he just couldn't accept that we couldn't just, why can't you just make it like the player controller and I'm on a bike, but it looks like I'm on a bike and I'm not really on a bike. It's like, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel right. That kind of makes sense, because any form of game where the player controller feels very much like the movement that you're trying, that's always unexpectedly delightful. So especially thinking like White Knuckle, which is all like rock climbing sort of thing, or Octodad as when you're moving around as an octopus, Endoparasitic when you're dragging yourself along the floor with one arm. But if a tank doesn't feel a tank, it's an expectation. We want the tank to feel like a tank. It's not that we don't expect it to feel that way, and then we're delighted that it does.
Yeah, that's something I noticed too, because like, I'm never going to be Lara Croft, right? I'm never going to do those backflips and all the stuff that she does. But
there's a gym in your neighborhood.
I appreciate that you think I could do that still. I have driven a car, right? And so like, I kind of have an understanding of how a car feels. And I don't know the specifics of like each individual car, but I have a general understanding of how a car would feel like. And I imagine a lot of players would feel similarly. Whereas like there's a suspension of disbelief behind like Nathan Drake or whoever doing parkour all over the cliffs or whatever. So there's a distinction that's important that I think you're emphasizing, and Lydia has too.
Yeah. And I think Mark's question about like what makes an airplane different.
Yeah.
That is actually something just like what you're talking about. People don't generally have experience flying aircraft outside of games or outside of flight simulators and stuff. So in some of those, it feels like there is a little bit more latitude where you can sort of, you know, be more creative with what it is. Yeah. And then there's other things that people do have, you know, real, you know, deep experience with. And if you violate any of those, you know, conventions or expectations, then it becomes challenging.
Right.
But the other part of it that a lot of people have real trouble with accurate simulations. I mean, like Forza or Gran Turismo and stuff like that, where they feel like, you know, in my car, I can go 40 miles an hour around an off ramp and there's no problem. And in this game, I'm going 20 miles an hour in my Ferrari and it's spinning out and I can't keep it under control. Yeah. You know, this is totally unrealistic. And that's a real challenge to sort of overcome. And part of it really comes down to just the limitations of conveying to the player what's happening in the simulation.
Right.
And how easy it is to exceed the performance envelope and have the, you know, tires lose traction. And if you're still applying the throttle, it's just going to make it worse. There's lots of dynamics and stuff like that where people sort of have an expectation, oh, this is a Porsche, this is a Ferrari, I should be able to do this at 90 miles an hour. And the truth is, you know, access to that those kinds of high performance vehicles, it's actually much easier to lose control than in a Civic or something, you know, that's a little bit more direct. But
and I suppose the more accurate the simulation is, which is a stated goal of these simulation games, mm-hmm. is you can never. I mean, let's say you get the full VR headset, rumble seat, all that stuff. That is not going to give you all the feedback with which you would probably need to actually learn how to drive these cars for real. Mm-hmm. It still is an abstracted simulation. So there's the designer's dilemma there is to like, I need to make it more realistic, but the more realistic you make it, the less approachable and ultimately the less realistic it becomes, right?
Sure.
Yeah, that's absolutely totally legitimate observation and concern. And, you know, it's funny because I enjoy real simulations. But what really comes down, and you sort of hinted at this a little bit, in a game, and especially in the old days, all you had was the TV and your controller. And if you were lucky, it might rumble.
Yeah.
but you're trying to convey to the player G-forces and acceleration and lateral slide and all these things that when you're in a real car, you get it from your butt. You intuit so much about what the vehicle's doing just from the physical sensation. And, you know, people, I have friends who work on industrial systems and stuff where they do the simulations of motion rigs and stuff like that. And you can spend, incredible amounts of money to get a system, but it still doesn't do it as far as like really conveying how the vehicle is behaving. So the limitations of audio, video, controller input, and haptics are pretty much all that you have as your toolbox. And it falls short in my experience for the most part. So, but at the same time, especially in like real world motorsports, there's a whole generation of kids who have grown up playing games and gotten progressively more sophisticated. Who, when they get the opportunity to drive a real car on a real racetrack or in a competitive situation, are unbelievably good. And it's like, you know, they have the reflexes, they have the intuition, they have all of that's been developed in simulators. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because talking to people in motorsports development, you know, they would much rather work with a game trained young driver than a young driver who grew up and went through the more traditional karting experience, or they've had because there's so many things that are different between the kart and a GT car and other open wheel cars and stuff like that that the gamer has experience to. but usually the kid who came up through the ranks in like real world motorsports are, and I don't mean to dismiss anybody, but they end up being much more focused on what they've had experience with, and they're it's not as general experience.
It sounds like, I mean, it's a facsimile, but it is a kind of a Cliff Notes version almost of the final goal, whereas the more traditional way of going through it, you are working with a different vehicle with different controls and haptics and physics and terrain to some extent, and you're changing that every single time you kind of go up that ladder. And I can understand how it would be really good experience, but it's a very different kind of experience going through that way, if depending on what you want from the final goal, if you're gunning for one particular type of racing and one type of vehicle versus a more broad sort of vehicle experience.
A gamer has an incomplete experience, but someone who's come up along the way has different experience. That can cross, it can get their wires crossed in a way that a gamer is just like, they'll be surprised by things, but it won't because they thought it would be something else.
More like, oh, this reminds me of it's kind of like this.
How the stick shift works.
As opposed to when you enter a new shower and you're like, where is everything?
Yeah.
I mean, that's an endorsement for that sort of pure simulation design, mm-hmm. which as I sort of alluded to is like, I feel that's a bit of a minefield, but it seems like you can't provide all the full experience, but like, okay.
Yeah.
Like maybe that's what you can provide, and it being not needing to abstract away a lot of it. Like it just means that it's not all there, but it still delivers.
Yeah. And I think Chris, it sounds like a lot of what you've been describing is the feel of this, of the activity. Like you said, there's limits to how much we could do that, but games in particular were very good at convincing players that they're actively doing a thing, even when they're just pressing a button on a controller or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it sounds like that is a large part of that experience, that the feel of it. even less than the physics itself.
Yeah, and it's hard to quantify. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times, the engagements I've had are because a team is frustrated that it doesn't feel right.
Sure,
and they don't know what feels wrong. They just know that it doesn't feel, you know, good or right or whatever.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I'd almost describe it as a talent rather than a skill in terms of vehicle design from the perspective of tuning systems that are tremendously complicated. And usually there's, you know, lots and lots of parameters. They're interconnected and the way they relate is, you know, not obvious. But I've had success in terms of like just walking into a situation, playing with the dynamics that they've got, working out something that feels pretty good to me, and then having, you know, the rest of the team say, oh my gosh, this is so much better than what we had before. But it's also challenging sometimes because a lot of the time, in my experience, people who are in the team working on specifically vehicle dynamics either don't feel like they have the aptitude or it's not something that they're personally interested in.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, I'm going through the motions and I've tuned this thing and I don't know, it's not, you know.
Yeah.
So I think having people who are, you know, passionate about it or who have, you know, real world experience and stuff like that can make a big difference.
Yeah, that was going to be the thing that I was going to ask next is like, is the love of it? Because this is true in all areas of games, but because this has a real world analog, whether you're designing sci-fi motorbikes or, you know, spaceships or whatever, there's a sort of an emotional connection you can make to things in the real world that many other things in games, the distance between what you're doing and what you could experience even is wider. Is that especially, like you described it as something people need to be sort of good at this. Is it something you need coming into the job? Is it something you can sort of learn as you go? If you love the engineering, can you learn the passion for the feel, or is it something that you have to develop separate from the work?
I think if you have it coming in, you're an advantage.
Okay.
I think but it's also the kind of thing where I think the player might not need to love it as much as the developer. I think the developer really probably needs to have that, you know, drive of this is my thing. And at the end of the day, it could be a game where the vehicles are just a part and players might like it or they might not, you know, be that core of a mechanic or whatever. But at the same time, I think people do develop that emotional connection. And on some of the projects I've worked on, there's been extensive player-based configuration and user-created content options and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the lengths that people go to like make their car or whatever, you know, theirs and it represents them. And when they're driving it around, they're so proud of, you know, how it looks and all the things. You know, as far as like similarities between character design and vehicle design from the cosmetics and the aesthetics, I think there's a lot of crossover potentially, depending on the game. But, you know, that can be a huge thing. It's like, it is an avatar for the player. Mm-hmm. And if they have agency and they can make it look, you know, the way they want, that can be a tremendous, you know, hook into the game. The other side of it that's not cosmetic can also be, you know, games that have performance upgrades or choices that players can make as far as which direction they want the vehicle to develop can also be huge. Okay. And you know, that's also kind of a can of worms sometimes, as far as like if you give the player the ability to adjust parameters in that dynamic, you know, we have to be really careful that they stay in a nice domain that, you know, keeps it viable and playable and that there aren't unexpected exploits.
Yeah, you don't want cars taking off on you or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, if I do the drift mechanic and I hit the handbrake at just the right time, it, you know, evaporates and I go into...
Yeah.
So the interview is going pretty well so far.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How do you think we're all doing fooling Chris into thinking that we know anything about cars?
I think we're doing pretty decently. I don't know.
I feel confident that we've got him.
I have not yet mentioned Wacky Racers for the Wii, so I think we're good.
Okay, okay.
Okay, okay.
Now, listener, if you have your own assessment on how well we're doing, you know, fitting in, you can give us feedback. Where, Steven?
Nicegames.club/feedback.
Yeah, you can tell us all about how this episode is, how past episodes are, what kind of shows you'd like to see from us, what ones we're doing maybe a little bit too many of. And then at the very end, there's a special field there to tell Steven specifically what he's wrong about.
Yeah, I'm probably wrong about cars in this episode. I don't remember because I wouldn't know that I was wrong.
So but, listen to the second half of the show where we reveal our ignorance or perhaps keep it under our hats and let us know what you think at nicegames.club/feedback.
I hadn't really considered character of a car in that way that you're describing it. But, I mean, of course, I'm just not into cars. I know I went to school for mechanical engineering for 5 years, but I flunked out for a reason. And the reason was I wasn't interested in cars, I guess. But I never really considered that, like, people are so into cars in that way of, like, providing some form of personality to the car. In not even just in terms of the aesthetics, but also the stats, I guess, of the car. Like, you know, maybe you want your car to go fast because you're a fast kind of player in a way that, like, I hadn't really thought about. So that opened my eyes there. Thank you for that.
Sort of depends on the game, too. Like, yeah. Some games allow a lot of that expression and some games don't.
Right.
And then some players, I suspect, probably, I mean, I imagine I'm just off the top of the dome thinking about, like, the motorcycle in Zelda.
Oh, sure.
That surprised everybody by existing.
Yeah.
Like, I think some people really, really loved it and probably felt it as a way to express themselves as Link, even though it wasn't customizable in any way.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. Yeah. Different ways to approach it. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like, with simulators in particular, I imagine people want to drive a Ferrari. They're not interested in driving their Ferrari in the same way.
Well, it's actually funny. Sometimes people do have, like, an emotional connection with a vehicle that... Like, for example, in the last Midnight Club game, when you started the game, you picked one of three entry-level cars. And one of them was like a Datsun 240 ZX. It was a little sports car, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you had quite a range. If you pursued all the performance upgrades and stuff like that,
yeah,
the level to which you could drive that starter car into the game was actually pretty deep.
Okay,
cool. And there were quite a few players who were like, you know, I'm gonna win the game. In this car, kind of thing, which was a real challenge, but people would put that effort into it because they loved it so much. Mm-hmm. Or it was, you know, my uncle had this car when I was growing up, or, you know, sometimes there is like an actual connection that people feel to it.
Right.
And so, yeah, they didn't want to, you know, upgrade to the actual sports car. They wanted to keep going with the one they had a connection with.
Weirdly enough, I encounter something similar in the Persona games because you have a starter. Persona is a JRPG and you get these creatures or sides of yourself called persona that have their own stats and abilities. Mm-hmm. And you always start with one. And a friend of mine always tried to beat the game with the original one. And as you play, you can level it up. But then there's also things you can do throughout the game to give it different or more abilities, change its stats, etc.
Right.
Beyond just like where it actually... Because after a certain point, it stops adding on new abilities. It just changes stats.
Yeah.
And some people get super attached to them and will just really go into essentially not modding in the sense of changing the code, but, you know, what is it, the word?
Like working within the bounds of this starting
game? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. And just like really try to soup it up and then win the game with it.
Yeah.
Because they get attached to that particular one in a very similar way.
Yeah, and I would almost pin that as a almost like a classic gamer behavior, because I'm thinking of this is maybe out of left field, but like Expedition 33.
Oh, sure.
In the middle of that game, it asks you to play it really differently now.
Yeah.
And I personally resisted that because I already liked what I was doing.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And that's just one example, but I think that must happen a lot, and that's like a larger expression of that. So I guess the question on this is, when you build a system that has a lot of possibilities, how do you actually convince a player to explore them all and not just sort of like find the little universe that they've carved out in the first half hour of the game that they've fallen in love with?
Yeah.
Or is it even really that big a problem? Am I overestimating?
Yeah. Or just like go faster, just dump everything in one stat.
Yeah.
Well, I've never observed players who didn't want to explore the range of what they had.
Oh, really?
Especially in games with vehicles that had performance upgrades and stuff.
Yeah.
It's sort of like you'd watch the metrics and you'd see them go crazy with like all sorts of different combinations that you wouldn't even necessarily expect.
Yeah.
And I think there's a gamer mentality of, you know, maybe trying to break the system or maybe trying to, you know, find exploits or things like that. So I haven't really experienced the, oh, I just want to stick with what I've got dynamic as much as I want to try everything and see what works the best for me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like I said, it can be a can of worms, especially for, you know, the developer. And when we made the transition from static vehicles like Miniclub 1 and Miniclub 2, you just had cars and you would get a better car and a better car and a better car. But you couldn't change anything about any one of them. And then in Midnight Club 3, we had a goal of introducing performance upgrades and making it so there was a garage and you could, you know, tweak different parts of it. And that was terrifying to the team because the generally the expectation was the tuning and everything was so fragile that if you added just a little bit in one area, it might not be fun anymore or, you know, whatever. And we ended up coming with, I think, was a pretty good solution where we tuned by hand a base model. And then we tuned by hand a hypothetically fully modified version.
Okay.
And then we broke up all the performance parts into different categories. And some had to do with power, some had to do with speed, some had to do with handling. And then we would take all the parameters between the base model and the upgraded model and assign percentages and stuff so that if you did pursue an upgrade path where all you did was add the speed and power stuff, you ended up with a car that was hard to drive.
Right, yeah.
As you might expect.
Too much of a good thing.
If you performed other dimension where you just went for, you know, handling and traction and suspension upgrades and stuff like that, you got something that drove like it was on rails, but it was really slow. And if you followed like a balanced path, you sort of stayed in this nice domain between the two points and you had a pretty convincing, you know, linear upgrade path. So,
and you still could like lean one way or the other, depending on if you like the traction versus the slippiness.
Exactly. And some, there's a little bit of an ego thing sometimes where players will intentionally sacrifice handling exchange for speed because they feel like, I'm such a good driver. I can overcome the lack of tire friction and just make, you know, if I get 5 miles an hour on the straights, that's going to make it, you know, all the difference. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes it's not. But
I imagine the audience for these kinds of games also tends to be people who want to explore the systems in that way.
Yeah. Players come in the door with wanting that.
Expedition 33 didn't properly prepare you for it, and so, you know, but Midnight Club 3 did a better job of that.
I'm actually kind of curious how, if one, have you ever had the chance to work on a game where you build vehicles a la Kerbal Space Program, and would you approach it in a similar way if you hadn't?
You know, I haven't had the opportunity. I think the game that I've played personally the most in that direction is like Banjo-Kazooie.
Nuts and Bolts. I like that game.
Nuts and Bolts. when my older son was young, he and I played that a tremendous amount. And it's I mean, it was a blast. And I think at the time I was considering, you know, I can't not look at the game from a designer perspective. And try it. You know, it's like, how did they approach it? How would they break it down? And I think what they ended up doing was coming up with just archetypes for the different vehicle classes and how they all worked. And I think what you ended up building wasn't as perverse in terms of the number of permutations as you might think it really was. But yeah, I mean, that's a game genre that I would certainly love to participate in, but I haven't had the opportunity.
Yeah, that's, I guess, a whole other can of worms in that, like, you know, you have your base systems of physics and stuff, and then now you're allowing players to manipulate the physics specifically.
And if it's successful and you do have a viable framework, you know, that's not that much different than what the designers do.
Right.
You know, they start off with the framework. They, you know, these are all the parameters we support. Here's the components you can add, and you construct whatever it is. If you start building things that have 20 wheels.
Well, it's that classic thing that all games with the more control you give the player, the more you invite them to be the designer, and the more instinct, like designers then have an instinct of like, well, these are the tools I'm doing. Let's give that to the player.
Yeah.
And they sometimes forget that what they're doing is work, and what they're offering the player should be fun.
Yeah.
And then once you figure it out, then you got to find a way to make those things different. Or there are some games where it's really just very similar, and it was just fun to design, and maybe the player will enjoy that as well. And so, yeah, you have to kind of decide where do you put the rails, to use a metaphor, on the player's ability to just tweak every single value in a way that, as you described earlier, can be very fragile. And that's true not just of like fully customizable experiences,
right,
but even in games where you're just take the car into the garage, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Have you driven fast cars yourself?
Yeah. Have you ever gone to do like defensive driving and been on a racetrack? And
how many twisted medals have you competed in?
I've yet to participate in a real world vehicular combat situation. but I am a motorsport enthusiast.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I had little motorcycles, like a little Honda Trail 70, a little putt-putt motorbike.
Oh, yeah.
And I lived adjacent to Griffith Park in Las Feliz in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And there were tons of horse trails. So from my house, you could just go into Griffith Park and drive around on the horse trails and stuff. And then as an older teenager, I had a little Kawasaki motorcycle. And after a couple accidents, my parents forced me to sell it. Nothing was, I mean, it was all low speed and real injury. But the car I chose to buy as a 17-year-old was a little Alfa Romeo. It was a 1974 Spider. And my family had crazy cars. My brother had like a RX3 coupe that my dad and he did a motor swap and dropped a 13B engine, which is the big rotary that the RX7 sports cars and stuff had.
Okay.
And that was also a little crazy. It was painted like a Japanese Zero fighter plane. Oh. So it had like big red dots on the side.
Oh.
My dad drove a hearse. It was like a 1968 Pontiac Bonneville. He was in satellite television and he wanted a vehicle that he could carry the big boxes that dishes came in, but be low enough that if he needed to put it on top, it wouldn't fall over like a van. Mm-hmm. And we had built in like all the tool chests and stuff into the bay. It was also coincidentally shortly after Ghostbusters had happened. So I was driving around in it.
But a lot of people had that idea.
Yeah.
Kind of cool. But yeah, when I guess the specific video game design crossover for me happened when I started working at Angel Studios. Mm-hmm. I had recently purchased a little Z3 BMW convertible sports car. And the guy who was the vehicle physics programmer had an S2000. And in San Diego, there had been a really active autocross community. And autocross is a sport. It's hard to describe without sounding really pathetic and lame.
Okay, try us.
It's okay, though, if it is.
Yeah.
you go to a really big parking lot or the best parking lot you can find, and you set up a course with cones, like pylons.
Yeah.
And it's a timed event where each car drives on its own. You're not wheel-to-wheel racing against other cars. But the goal is to complete a lap as fast as you can. And we use sophisticated timing equipment, and it's down to thousandths of a second and, you know, stuff like that.
Okay.
And people take it very seriously.
Oh, yeah.
As you might imagine.
It sounds like gymnastics, in that everybody goes one to one and it is milliseconds or like deductions of points.
Yeah.
And it's like all eyes on you in this moment. And then you have to just sit there and wait until everyone else does their turn. Like, I can see it.
Yeah. Well, what it reminds me of actually is LARPing, in that
it
replicates all of the things of a cooler thing. But it's kind of nerdy.
Yeah.
And I imagine that community maybe wouldn't like that characterization, but I say, like, you know, hold on to it. That's great.
It's
accurate.
Yeah, that seems cool.
Yeah. But it's also approachable. I mean, you can do it. Like, I participated mostly with the SCCA, which is the Sports Car Club of America, but the Porsche Club and the BMW Club and the Miata Club and the Corvette Club, they all did their own events too.
Yeah.
So depending on what allegiance you had automotively, you know, you could participate in different groups. But you know, the SCCA, it's a sport, and it's approachable. It's grassroots motorsports. Anybody, you know, with a driver's license and a car that was manufactured in the last 40 years, you know, could participate in. And then there's different categories where if your car is completely stock, it falls into this, you know, group. But then the more you've modified it, if you've done suspension or power or, you know, any sort of upgrades, there become different categories. So you could be in street prepared or fully modified or, you know, whatever. And, you know, the competition was fun. But I guess where I'm going is this guy, Jeff, who is the vehicle programmer, and I would participate together. And especially on like practice days when it wasn't a competition, you were allowed to ride with your friends. So we'd be in the car together, losing control. But talking about, oh, we need to have that in the game, or, you know, this is what I was trying to talk about the other day, or, you know, whatever. And learning that kind of motorsport dynamic in a real car did teach me tremendous. I mean, yeah. I had always had sports cars and the motorcycles and stuff like that as a kid, but the autocross was tremendous in terms of providing a safe environment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That
to
seems
totally
key.
Lose
yeah.
control.
Yeah. Yeah.
And getting a sense of the way the vehicle, a real car actually behaves when you exceed the performance envelope and you're a passenger. It actually did dramatically change. I do not drive aggressively on the street mm-hmm. anymore. Partly because I know how easy it is to lose control.
Right.
And you know, it's different. But God forbid, you know, if you're in a rain or traction limited or you know something happens and you do start to spin out mm-hmm. on the street, having an understanding of at least what to expect or where the car is probably going to end up or how things are going to go, you know.
Yeah.
It could be a life or death difference.
That's the beauty of games and why, because I work in positive impact games, so educational games a lot of the time, that's the thing that is so core and wonderful about them as a medium is it is a safe place to fail.
Right.
Yeah. Like you have essentially experienced that in real life and then and being able to bring some more of that into the game space where it is safer, even safer to fail.
Yeah.
Right. And so Jeff and I would work, you know, and I think having that experience, and especially with the programmer that I was, you know, was my counterpart, was tremendous because it helped us establish a vocabulary on what we were talking about. We had real world experience that we could base the, you know, game dynamics on. So yeah, I personally feel like that was fundamentally, you know, significant in terms of my development as a vehicle designer. And you know, from there, I have been unbelievably privileged in my opportunities to continue to have sports cars and, you know, have the financial capacity to go to racetracks and participate in time trials and track day. I have shied away from real world competitive wheel to wheel racing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And partially from my experience in games, I know that if there's a trophy involved, another driver is going to put my life at risk,
yeah.
you know, to win or to make that pass or whatever. So, you know, my participation in track days and stuff has really been just time trials and open track and, you know, fun, you know, where it's fine if you're just driving 7/10 or you're just having a good time with your car or you're really pushing and you're trying to, you know, improve or whatever. But, you know, it's been just recreation. And especially at my age, I know there's, you know, 17-year-olds out there who are unbelievably talented and have reflexes that I can't even really imagine or remember having that, you know, would make it so I'm not competitive.
That's also something that we see in games, right? Because I am not a competitive person. If there is competition,
people who like whoop us?
I don't like competitive things.
Yeah.
I do like me versus environment or me versus the vehicle or me versus the thing.
Yeah.
And that is where the focus of the time trials really seems to be. It's you versus the road, you and your car. Whereas with peer to peer racing, it is you against a person.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to be that you're in a car. It's almost like you're decentering the car, but if you love the car so much, I don't know.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, having that background in games probably gives you a much, you probably got to that. I'm sure there are other people who do motorsport recreationally who have very similar attitudes and have a mature approach to it. But it sounds like games really got you there sort of faster and better to that idea of like, what is really interesting, valuable, rewarding, and entertaining about this versus, you know, what is just the sort of like base instinct lizard brain stuff that, you know, we put in our games a lot.
Yeah. And like, how do I like to play?
Yeah.
Right. And it's a testament to like the importance of having that real world experience. I mean, not everybody's going to have the opportunity to drive a Ferrari, but I mean like driving in some semi-competitive experience that like a lot of your games that you have worked on also have that kind of an experience. It allows you to provide that experience and makes the game feel more real as a result.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important aspect of it.
Yeah, people can absolutely can get that vicarious experience through someone who's done it.
Yeah.
Now, then I guess the button on this section is if someone else has the kind of jobs that you have in the industry, do they need that background that you have, or do they just benefit from it?
I think it would be a benefit, but not an absolute requirement.
Yeah.
You know, and I like I said, like with the kids who grew up playing Gran Turismo and stuff all the time, it's like they can develop a really strong intuition without ever, you know, even getting their driver's license yet.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess that's the maybe we can bring the episode to a close by talking really about the actual mechanical assembly of these systems.
Yeah.
So maybe we can frame it as if someone is interested in, I think a lot of people, game developers who have, you know, they've just, you know, they've done some physics simulation to get wheels moving or whatever. They've used their built-in things from the engine to sort of like, oh, I built a car. Here's an axle.
Right.
Like, what is the next step past just the basics assembling a vehicle? How do you, what is the first and most important thing to start playing with, toying with, adjusting to start getting to, whether you're going for a cart game or a transportation game or a simulation game?
Yeah.
The most critical thing in pretty much every simulation experience I've had is the tire model. How, if it's a terrestrial vehicle, how the wheel interacts with the ground. And you can really simplify it, and you can just have, you know, a fairly simple mathematical function that describes the friction, and as the torque increases, it peaks and then it falls, and you can have something that's kind of, you know, relatively approachable and fun to just spin or drift with that simple model. But the reality is people expect more, I think, most of the time. And, you know, really complicated tire models incorporate things as far as, you know, the geometry of the suspension, where every little degree of camber makes a difference, and how stiff the sidewall of the tire is, and how much lateral, you know, deformation it'll do before it starts to slip, and how the rotate. So the tire model is probably the most, like, important. But at the same time, suspension, weight transfer, getting it so that, you know, part of it's visual, but like if the car appears just like rigid as a block, it's unconvincing.
Yeah.
So the more there's actual movement and, you know, momentum and sway and stuff like that can make a huge, even if it's just visual, it really sort of helps convey what's going on. But I think to answer your question, in my experience with most of the models and systems that I've worked with, there's typically three layers, and it's important to sort of understand and to some degree keep them separate. But at the core, you need as good a real-time physics engine simulation as your engineers can muster. And that should incorporate the tires and the transmission and the engine and the suspension and all the nuts and bolts that you think of as the vehicle simulation. And you, if you're successful, you can get that. So it's kind of fun to just play with that all on its own as a relatively raw simulation. And then on top of that, typically, we add in artificial gyroscopic forces. And that's what makes it more approachable most of the time, what people perceive as like arcadey. And it makes it so that, when the player provides an input with extreme steering and hard throttle, we actually twist the car. The simulation says you've probably lost traction and you're no longer, you know, driving, you're just sliding.
Yeah.
But we add artificial forces to make it behave the way people expect, even if that violates the simulation.
Sure.
And then the third level on top of that is the controller input. And it really makes a huge difference whether it's a PC game and all you've got digital keyboard input, or if it's a console game and you've got a nice analog range of inputs, or it's a seated rig simulation thing where you've got actual pedals and real steering wheel and, you know, all those kinds of things. But the way that the inputs are considered is absolutely critical. And they sort of filter from one to the next. So typically the input controller layer drives how we apply the artificial forces. We had, like, in Midnight Club, there were recovery mechanisms so that if the car was spinning out and we know that the player is counter steering to try and regain control, mathematically, it's fairly trivial to calculate what the ideal steering input would be to save the car in that situation. And you can gently guide the input to that.
Right.
The player feels like they're awesome.
Yeah.
And I was out of, but I saved it. And now, so, having those layers sort of percolate from one to the next, where, you see what they're doing with the controller, you apply an artificial force or whatever, and then the ultimate real, how that gets percolated through in the simulation is what comes across as the vehicle system.
So, yeah. Okay.
In addition to that, there's all sorts of, The camera systems are absolutely critical.
Right.
If it's just a camera on a stick, or if it's got, you know, stuff coming back, audio, haptics, all the other things as far as vibration and stuff sort of get sprinkled on. But I think the sim, gyro, and input layers are sort of the core.
Okay. I was actually wondering if you have to bring the same level of attention that you do the tires to the ground or the road as well to get those physics to really feel good.
Oh, yeah.
Surprisingly not, or at least in my experience, not as much as you would expect.
Huh.
Some games are track racers, and like the track is a fundamental aspect of level design,
right.
as you might expect. And in those games, yeah, the camber, the way the surface is modeled, the resolution of the tessellation, all of that does come into play. But in other games where it's like H1Z1, massive, you know, open world situation, you don't have the art budget to have that much, you know, the ground terrain is going to be pretty coarse.
Sure.
But from most of my experience, the ground and the way that it interacts with the wheel is less important.
Okay.
And there's usually a surprising amount of tolerance, you know, and like in some games we ended up, like for curbs and stuff, there actually was never a face. It was always just the two flat surfaces.
Oh.
And the wheel just translates from one to the other, and, you know, it's not a problem.
Wow. Not even like a variances in friction?
Yeah.
Wow. Did not expect that.
Yeah. Cars are powerful, I guess.
Well, not. I really wish that this was in October so we could say, but put on your winter tires. Be careful. This is a game.
Right, right.
I was going to say, like, a lot of this must be contextual. Like, what, you know, like all games, you put in what the game needs.
Yeah.
And if you're doing a parallel parking simulator, you would want the side of the curb.
Yes.
Because that plays a role more often than you want it to.
Right, right. Yeah.
Speaking from experience?
Perhaps.
I know I am.
But yeah, most of the times you wouldn't. I suppose that then, and those must be sort of surprising, like, oh, of course.
Yeah.
Like, what do we need that for? You know, challenging assumptions, right?
Well, it's a lot of the same decisions you would make in any form of design, right? Like, you fudge the numbers a little bit so the player feels good or the player feels bad, if that's what you're going for. Those little, I guess, tools of the trade sort of ways to change how the player feels in any given moment. It works in all forms, including in vehicle design.
It goes back to the very beginning of this conversation, which is like when you say you sort of artificially guide the player back to the correct counter steering, partly because they don't have the feedback to maybe present the correct input. Maybe a game controller actually doesn't have the same input resolution that a full steering wheel does.
Right.
And you want it to feel good. That reminds me a lot of like when you're jumping in a platforming game, there's very few that don't let you control the character in the air.
Yes.
Because that feels right, not because it is right.
Mm-hmm.
And even in a vehicle simulation game, the ultimate goal is that it's got to feel right.
Yeah.
And sometimes you fool the player into thinking it's fully, you know, world accurate, and sometimes you tell the player it's this, you know, fantasy environment, so they can get a real handle on those systems.
Yeah,
and that's what makes those different. But they both have the same goal, which is it should feel right, right?
In my experience, that's how you know you've kind of succeeded, or at least you're on the right track, is you watch the testers and stuff, and if they're just driving the cars around,
then you did it. All right,
it's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I think listeners are going to have a lot to chew on for this.
Yeah, I know I will.
Indie games will have a wide range of approaches to vehicles. And I think it's nice to hear from an expert some of the things that may seem like, at first glance, this is what we need for these bigger games. But really, when you drill down to it, this is great advice for every step of the way.
Yeah.
You know, whatever context you're providing this in. So that was really exciting to sort of be able to filter through. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you guys.
That's our show. You can find Chris online at robertsmania.com and simracingstreamers.com. For those notes and additional links from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode or others or whatever with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. But that is it for this week. So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.